at red gingham-covered picnic tables, while tunes by Willie Nelson and Lefty Frizzell played over the speakers. It was spring 2019, and the guests had come for the inaugural Camp Tazo, or Tazo, a three-day adult camp hosted by Tazo Tea Company, which had invited participants from all over the country to come together to brew the unexpected. Even some of the barbecue sauce was Tazo-infused. Sauntering among the attendees was Camp Tazo's director, part MC, part life coach, a drag queen named Alyssa Edwards. Edwards is 5'9", but 6'1" in heels, her dancers' gams rising out of size 10 platforms. She'd highlighted and contoured her pale, freckled cheekbones until they looked sharp enough to cut glass, and she wore inch-long false eyelashes. Her platinum bouffant took seriously the old adage about hair height and God. She was a hard-to-miss bombshell. Edwards caught the attention of 11-year-old Trinity Sager, who was visiting with her family as part of Project Sanctuary, a charity that hosts the therapeutic retreats for military families. Trinity asked her parents, Rob and Judy Sager, if she could introduce herself to Edwards, and the Sagers found someone who looked likely to be in charge to ask Edwards if she would be willing to meet a young fan. When she responded with enthusiasm, Rob Sager led the way. Edwards took in Rob, a barrel-chested Marine veteran with a graying goatee. Hi, I'm Justin, she said, deploying her offstage name. She extended her violet press-on nails to shake the hands of both parents while Trinity and her 10-year-old brother, Caleb, stood nervously nearby. Edwards, 40, is a world-famous drag queen, star of a season of the reality competition show RuPaul's Drag Race, and later a season of RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars. Though she didn't win either season, she remains one of the franchise's biggest success stories. She recently returned to All Stars as a lip sync assassin. She has 1.8 million Instagram followers and ranked fifth on Vulture's 2019 list of the 100 most powerful drag queens in America. She's known for her bright outfits, big hair, and sprightly dance moves. She is beloved for her country fried malapropisms and what one fellow contestant referred to as her off-the-cuff buffoonery responses. She sells her own makeup palette, has her own signature sound, the tongue pop, and has headlined shows all over the United States, Canada, and Europe, and as far away as Australia. Trinity Sager had recognized Edwards from the Netflix reality series Dancing Queen. The show followed the students of an elite children's dance studio, Beyond Belief Dance Company, then located in Mesquite. The dance company is owned and operated by the man beneath the makeup, Justin Johnson. Trinity stayed silent while Edwards chatted with her parents. Let's take a picture. Come on, you guys, Edwards suddenly cooed, waving Trinity and her brother over. Edwards wrapped her arms around both kids and gave a thumbs up to the camera while Rob snapped the shot. Then the Sager said goodbye and headed back to their room. As soon as Edwards was out of earshot, Caleb turned to his family and said, she's tall. Once they were gone, Edwards turned her attention back to Camp Tazo. She was off to host the night's big activity, a hidden talent show in the nearby pavilion. There were glittering streamers, club music, and luxuriant outfits. One guest wore an antique birdcage for a hat. Another camper wore a full Prince Charming costume with puffy Elizabethan sleeves, a crown, and a pair of big sparkly heels that would later be gifted to Edwards in tribute. Fueled by corporate-sponsored tea, campers laughed, cheered, and even shed a few tears as they watched their newfound BFFs dance, sing, mime, and joke on stage. At the end of the night, after a rousing dance and sing-along to the ABBA hit Dancing Queen, Edwards stood among the crowd. Under the sanguine lighting of the pavilion, she turned earnest. For a lot of years, I was so unaware, almost lost or in the dark, and then I put a wig on for the first time, Edwards told her audience. It gave me the courage, she added. It was kind of like my cape to be a superhero. A few decades ago, a collaboration between a drag queen and a multinational conglomerate like Unilever, which owns Tazo, would have been unlikely. But since RuPaul began building the drag race empire, mainstream appreciation for drag, once a subversive underground art form, has swelled. In 2018, RuPaul's DragCon, a series of multi-day conventions in New York and Los Angeles, and this year in London, attracted around 100,000 visitors and netted a reported $8 million in revenue. Drag queens have starred in international drag race spinoffs and have appeared in Golden Globe-nominated films, scripted cable shows, and a new reality franchise that aired on HBO this year. Drag has entered a golden age, and Alyssa Edwards is at the heart of it. On a Thursday evening in November, Beyond Belief was as busy as a mall food court on a pre-pandemic Saturday afternoon. All three of the studio's practice rooms were occupied by groups rehearsing their routines. The small foyer was full of moms talking about their kids. Even the hallway was packed. Half a dozen children under seven held onto a ballet bar and practiced their foot positions beneath plaques and collages celebrating Beyond Belief's successes. Johnson hot-footed among them all. He was wearing his studio clothes, mustard yellow track pants, all black Adidas sneakers, and a black tank top that exposed a tattoo on his right bicep. His posture was impeccable, and even without Alyssa Edwards' makeup, his freckled cheekbones and blue-green eyes were striking. He'd pop his head into the main office to confer with office manager Dawn Robbins, then would run out to the lobby to ask the mom something. He spent most of his time in the back room, walking the youngest group through a new routine. The students, all girls, wore white plush gloves and danced to a mashup that included a Lizzo remix in which Minnie Mouse sings, "I just took a DNA test. Turns out I'm 100% that mouse." Johnson often leaped onto the dance floor to demonstrate the moves. "A ding and a ding and an open and a ding," he said, on beat as he guided the kids through the hand motions. When he was at rest, he perched on an elevated prop trellis decorated with huge red roses in the back of the room. "His energy level is just, it's crazy," says Robbins, who was succeeded at as office manager by Kelly Epton in early 2020. Robinson worked at Beyond Belief since its early days. She first met Johnson in 2007 when he started teaching her youngest daughter, Celeste, who now dances with choreographer Marie Chouinard in Canada and teaches a few summer classes at Beyond Belief. "He'll stay up until 1 or 2 in the morning talking to dance moms, then pop up at 6 a.m. and go work out and go to the bank. He must be driving like a maniac all over town. He'll call me and go, 'I've done this and this and this,' and I'll say, 'Whoa, I'm just drinking my morning coffee.'" Alyssa Edwards is famous all over the world, but Johnson feels most at home while teaching at Beyond Belief, a business he's been building since 2004, years before he first competed on RuPaul's Drag Race. Johnson opened Beyond Belief in Mesquite, where he grew up, but in August 2018, he moved the studio to a larger location in a nondescript Garland office park on the edge of Lake Ray Hubbard. The company is the reason he's never really considered moving to New York or Los Angeles, cities that other RPDR alums have flocked to after their big breaks. "Alyssa is larger than life and fabulous," Johnson says, "but I think I'm a better teacher and choreographer than performer." Around 9 p.m., as the studio was clearing out, Johnson called Kira Lee, a 10-year-old dancer, into the windowless back room he and Robbins used as an office. He asked Kira to take a seat on the good couch. He wanted to check in quickly before she went home with her mother, Vanessa Lee, who was standing nearby. I want you to know that everybody here believes in your ability. Every single teacher here," Johnson told Kira, hunching over slightly so he could make more direct eye contact with her. "I want you to get out of your head when you're given a critique," he continued. "You're here because you want to be critiqued. Ultimately, for the bigger goal, not to win just competitions, but to win in life." He asked Kira what grade out of 100 she would give herself for the season. 85, she said apprehensively, after reassurances from Johnson, her mother, and Robbins that there was no wrong answer. Okay, replied Johnson. Is that the grade you want to have? You know that score can't win with a solo, right? Okay, so you got to say, okay, what can I do to get a 90 or above? That's just 5 more points. He continued, explaining that critiques were good. If your director didn't notice you, on the other hand, that would be a bigger problem. Johnson told Kira how blessed she was that her mom came to all her dance practices. His mother had not been able to do the same. Kira, he said, was the only person standing in Kira's way. After a high five, Johnson told her, all right, thank you, baby. And he turned to her mother, offering to help if she ever needed him to give Kira a ride home. I know you got other kids doing other things, and I don't mind, he said. Johnson considers many of the dance moms family. A few years ago, after he bought his first home in a gated community just outside Mesquite, they helped him move out of the Oaklawn apartment he'd lived in for years. They came to his house parties and his rec league games. He started playing in his gay kickball league on Saturday mornings, says one dancer's mother, whose daughter started dancing with Beyond Belief in 2018. He went to one game, and then we were all, well, we're coming. When do you play? Then, of course, we show up in full T-shirts, pom-poms, kids, everybody. They're like, Justin brings a family. She initially balked at Johnson's teaching style, she explains. He doesn't coddle, and he isn't stingy with critiques. He holds the students to high standards, but only because he's certain they can meet them. His expectations, as a mom, you want to say they're not realistic. But how do you know they're not realistic? Because I've watched my daughter meet those expectations that I would have never had thought she'd be able to meet. I would have given you an excuse before. Johnson likes to say, if you can make it at this studio, you're going to be ready for the professional world. In addition to dance technique, he teaches his students how they, like him, can build a career from their creative passions, if that's what they want. At the very least, says Andrea Canterbury, whose daughter Riley has danced with Johnson since she was 8. I mean, good gosh, they'll have something great on their resume. Some of Johnson's young students have already begun to capitalize on the platform Dancing Queen provided them. Since Netflix released the show in 2018, some students have acquired not insubstantial social media followings, which in almost any industry is leveraged for gigs and sponsorships. Riley, for example, has almost 11,000 Instagram followers. Another student, Kiana Sanderson, who struggled with Johnson's often harsh criticism on Dancing Queen, has almost as many. Now 19, she just finished her freshman year at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, and she helps teach some of the younger students at Beyond Belief. She's already done some sponsored posts repping BU brand apparel, a clothing line for kids and teenagers whose designs often involve rhinestones and statements like girls rule. Kiana's little sister, Leah, who is 13 years old, is also a BU boss who occasionally advertises products to her 10,700 Instagram followers. Leah was born with a lipoma on her spine. She's already had 3 spinal surgeries and lives with chronic pain and spina bifida. Because of the location of the tumor, she's had 20 bladder surgeries. Her parents started homeschooling her after she missed 90 days of third grade, and since then the studio has become her favorite place to be. Johnson allows her to come into the studio early if she needs to, and sometimes he gives her one-on-one instruction. It's kind of a place for me to escape, Leah says. When I'm having a bunch of struggles at home or with my health, I just kind of go to dance and forget about everything and dance my heart out. Johnson has been teaching kids to dance since he was still technically a kid studying dance. Back in the late 90s, when he was at West Mesquite High School, Johnson started volunteering as an instructor and choreographer with the local Pee Wee drill team. That's a huge commitment, he recalls, with daily practices from 6 to 8 in the evening and games on Saturday afternoons. But I was out there running those drill teams and running that field. He'd been fascinated by the drill team since he was a little kid, watching his sisters at their practices, wishing he could join. He's one of the oldest of 7 kids in a working-class family. He describes his mother as the wind beneath my wings and his father as very, very masculine. Johnson was a shy, creative boy. He had no interest in sports, but loved The Wizard of Oz, and he would sit silently, glued to the television set whenever his mother put it on. Somewhere in the Johnson family archives exists an old VHS recording of a 10 or 11-year-old Johnson running around in the front yard in overalls and no shirt, waving a ribbon through the air, singing Rod Stewart's Forever Young at the top of his lungs. Johnson remembers his father telling him, "You need to take that to the backyard." "I didn't know what I was. I didn't know where I fit in. I didn't know my place," Johnson says of his childhood in Mesquite, a suburb that self-identifies as the rodeo capital of Texas. Johnson's place turned out to be the Joy Sharp School of Dance in North Mesquite. When he was 9, Johnson saw an ad in the newspaper for an all-boys jazz class that would cost $10 a month. Though money was tight, he knew he could get the tuition from either his maternal grandmother or his Uncle Bobby, an openly gay actor who always fostered his nephew's artistic side, including getting young Dustin a role as an extra in the local community college production of Brigadoon. Johnson was able to persuade his dad to let him go only because the son of a local baseball coach also happened to take jazz classes. Joy Sharp, who had been running the studio for years, quickly took a shine to the small, freckled kid with all that energy and those emotive eyes. One day, when Johnson's grandmother came to pick him up from class, Sharp took her aside and said Johnson had talent, creativity, and a strong work ethic, all attributes that would make him an excellent dancer. "He's extraordinary," Sharp said. Johnson, listening in, beamed. The first time in his life, a coach complimented him. "Dance, I want to say, saved my life," Johnson recalls. His teen years were not easy. He was conflicted about being gay, and he struggled with his parents' eventual divorce. Teenage Johnson was grappling with big, complicated emotions, but he could channel them into dance. "It was just a place for me to communicate," he says of Sharp's studio, "and feel like I belonged somewhere." After high school, Johnson moved a couple hours west to attend Ranger College, a two-year school in Ranger, later transferring to the University of North Texas in Denton. By then, he'd been coaching junior drill teams and assistant teaching with some competitive dance squads, but he took a couple years off to focus on himself. He joined the UNT cheer squad, but it didn't hold his attention for long. "I was born to be inside a studio in tights," he says. "All of this out here in this heat, this Texas heat, on this football field, flipping and all, it's not made for me." While he was in college, he came out as gay. "I discovered, you know, self-discovery," he says. His mother said she'd known he was gay since she started to walk and talk. His father was less supportive, though he eventually came around. In a moving episode of the behind-the-scenes series RuPaul's Drag Race, Untucked, he recorded a message of support from home for Edwards. "I know Dad was a hard-ass," he said, "but I'm proud of you and who you are and what you become." At UNT, Johnson made friends with other gay students, and sometimes they would all drive down to Dallas to the blocks around the intersection of Cedar Springs Road and Oaklawn Avenue, just north of downtown. That was considered Dallas's gayborhood. The streets in Oaklawn, as the neighborhood is known, were filled with businesses that specifically catered to Dallas's LGBT community. There was JR's Bar and Grill, a gay club on Cedar Springs that opened in 1980, and the lesbian down the street from it, Sue Ellen's, which opened in 1989. Across the road was the Roundup Saloon, which touts itself as the nation's best gay country western dance hall, and the clothing store Union Jack, owned and operated by a gay English expat since 1971. Johnson dined at an old-fashioned burger joint named Hunky's. "I remember being so at a loss for words," says Johnson, "and calling my mother saying, 'Mom, do you know there's a whole community, a whole neighborhood?'" A popular spot in Oaklawn was the Village Station, now Station 4, which had a huge dance floor with a disco ball, where Johnson would stay until long after they set off the confetti cannons at midnight. It was there in the upstairs Rose Room Lounge that Johnson stumbled on to his first drag show, an experience he likens to a kid going to Disney for the first time. He couldn't take his eyes off the queens on stage. They were so over the top, so campy. He stood at the back of the room, giggling. He noticed how people in the audience would show their appreciation for the entertainer by handing them crumpled dollar bills. He also noticed the smiles on everyone's faces. The atmosphere, the energy was magnetic, he recalls. It just all made sense to me. By the time a 20-year-old Johnson arrived at the Village Station in 2000, Dallas already had one of the most established drag scenes in the state. The city's drag history dates back to the 50s, when the cabaret Le Beau sur les Toits, later renamed Villa Fontana, opened in Bryan Place, about 2.5 miles southeast of where Station 4 is now. According to a rigorous 2011 thesis on the rise of Dallas's LGBT community from Karen S. Wisely at UNT, Dallas was also home to Texas's first gay bar, Club Reno, a downtown beer joint that opened in 1947. The city's first organization for gay men, the Circle of Friends, was founded in 1965 and hosted Dallas's first known gay pride parade in 1972. The community that Johnson discovered in Oak Lawn was the product of decades of organization on the part of gay and lesbian Dallasites. In the 70s, gay bars and businesses started opening up along Cedar Springs Road, and organizations like the Dallas Gay Political Caucus fought for equitable treatment under the law through lobbying and litigation. Confronted with the AIDS epidemic of the 80s, the community became even more close-knit as it rallied to take care of its own. Drag performances were a crucial part of fundraising efforts. In 1995, drag was popular enough in Dallas for the Dallas Morning News to publish a piece with the headline, "Cross-Dress for Success, Drag Queen Biz is Booming, From Performances to Pageants." Drag queens, said the article, were not just becoming more visible, they were becoming big business. The paper cited the Rose Room as an example, the dedicated drag venue which had opened atop the Village Station in 1991, was routinely packed, attracting straights and gays of varying ages to the multiple hour-long performances it hosted every weekend night. The Dallas area has sent more queens to drag race than any other city in Texas. Aside from Edwards, there's Sahara Davenport, Kennedy Davenport, and Acaria Chanel Davenport. There's also Plastique Tiara, Asia O'Hara, and Shangela Loquifa Wadley, also known as DJ Pierce. Pierce started out as one of Edwards' backup dancers when he was a student at SMU and now has his own HBO show, We're Here. I'm always respected Texas drag, Pierce says, because it was so elegant and glamorous, and it was big hair and jewelry and performance and being a showgirl who was competing in pageants. You know, it was just a beautiful thing, and I really loved being part of that world. Back in 2000, Johnson learned quickly. Started going to the Rose Room regularly, showing up early to get a good seat for performances by established drag queens like Whitney Page, Maya Douglas, and Victoria West. One time, he noticed a poster advertising amateur night, and he told his friends he was going to enter the competition. He didn't really know anything about drag, but his experiences in competitive dance made him confident in his ability to entertain. And this was 5 years before YouTube was founded, so there were no online tutorials to teach Johnson how to contour, highlight, or paint the dramatic fake eyebrows that many drag queens apply. He took what little he had learned about makeup from his sisters and tried to make himself look as much like them as possible. He didn't even buy a wig. He just slicked back his then platinum blonde hair like Annie Lennox. Before the show, the MC asked what his drag name would be. Johnson picked Alyssa because he'd watched Who's the Boss with his family growing up, and he thought Alyssa Milano had it all. The looks, the grace, and the sass that Johnson would want his drag self to exude. When he finally got on stage, Johnson channeled Milano in his performance. He danced his ass off, and he won. It wasn't long before Edwards' talent attracted the attention of more experienced drag queens like Paige and Lincoln Edwards, the drag mother from whom Alyssa would get her last name. They mentored Edwards, and soon she was a top-tier pageant queen, winning Miss Gay Texas America in 2005, Miss Gay U.S. of A. in 2006, and then Miss Gay America in 2010, a title she had to relinquish when her commitment to Beyond Belief conflicted with the public appearances that came with the crown. The scandal of Edwards' ceded Miss Gay America title became a major plot point in season 5 of RuPaul's Drag Race, on which Edwards competed against Coco Montrese, the former 2010 Miss Gay America runner-up who had taken over the duties Edwards had renounced. The played-up drama turned them into some of the franchise's most memorable frenemies. Who could forget the time when Edward said, "Girl, look how orange you effing look," about Coco's makeup, or when Coco shouted, "I'm not joking, bitch," at Edward's. Their performances were so iconic that 3 years later, both of them were brought back to compete against each other on season two of RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars, though by then their feud seems to have fizzled. It was on All-Stars' second season, generally considered to be one of the greatest drag race seasons of all time, that Edwards cemented her status as a drag world idol. She was eliminated in an episode 7, but her bigger, blonder looks and her humor, the intentional and unintentional, made her a highlight of the season. One of her fellow competitors, Katia Zamolodchikova, called her the most memorable creature to ever walk through that door. Beyond Belief shut down temporarily in March 2020 due to COVID-19 concerns, but Johnson couldn't bear it. By June, the studio was back for what Johnson referred to as a soft opening. No more than 4 or 5 kids in class at a time, with taped squares on the dance floor to keep students at least 6 feet apart. Since Alyssa Edwards' first season on Drag Race in 2013, Johnson has remained devoted to Beyond Belief. If anything, he put even more thought and energy into what he can accomplish there. In the last 5 years, he's focused a lot on that, says Robbins, who's known Johnson since he was in his late 20s, driving a rundown Mazda with a smashed-in side that he couldn't afford to fix. He now drives a Mercedes. He's really interested in the development of these kids, their maturity, self-discipline, and work ethic. Good little spot here to remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Sight into Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight into Sound Broadcasting since 1967. Now, back to our text. He's even brought the kids into the Alyssa Edwards world. They rode with Edwards on a float in Dallas's 2019 Pride Parade, and they performed with her on stage at RuPaul's Drag Con in 2016 in Los Angeles. Last year, when the makeup company Anastasia Beverly Hills released the limited edition Alyssa Edwards palette, which features colors with names like Inspire and Texas Made, Johnson brought a group of Beyond Belief dancers for a flash mob at the Sephora at North Park Center. Each of the kids got their own palette and a makeup tutorial. DJ Pierce says he and Johnson have had the "Why Stay in Mesquite" conversation plenty of times since Alyssa Edwards became a household name. If Johnson wanted to explore the opportunities in a more television or film, then New York or L.A. definitely would be a place for him. But his first love and his life passion is the Beyond Belief Dance Studio. You can just tell whenever he talks about it. He has a great passion for that school to the point where he's given a lot of his own personal money just to create scholarships for a lot of the dancers. That Thursday night in November, reclining cross-legged in one of the office's black leather armchairs after Kira and her mother had left, Johnson looked totally at ease. It had been a productive practice, and as usual, he'd had a blast. "Have you ever met the real Hannah Montana? Because you're looking at her," he said. Johnson, like the Disney Chanel heroine, leads a fabulous double life. He swept his arms in a circle. "It's a blessing," he said. In his mind, the studio was just as magical as any stage upon which Alyssa Edwards has planted her platform heels. The space was the opposite of the packed floor of Drag Con, where Edwards' fans wait in line for hours to meet their idol. The bland office park in which the studio sat was in stark contrast to the glittering Smirnoff-sponsored Pride Parade float Edwards rode through New York City last June. The studio was silent now, but an industrious, creative energy still hung in the air, and Johnson seemed to want to soak it up a while longer. He knows he could start another elite dance studio on one of the coasts, but he said, "This is home. I couldn't live without this. I couldn't create this in L.A. I've officially planted my roots, and I'm here to stay. I want to be a part of this community. I want to be a bluebonnet that blooms all year round, that people are proud of. Turning next to the state, this is The Culture, it's books by Evan Mintz, and in this month's column entitled Prophetic City or Pathetic City? Rice sociologist Steven Kleinberg's portrait of Houston focuses on the busts, not the booms, and still remains optimistic. On one of the side effects of living in a city that runs on oil and gas is that time feels cyclical. Instead of progressing from past to the future, life in Houston has historically alternated between boom and bust. It's as if the city runs on some Mayan calendar that repeats itself over and over as, according to one controversial interpretation, it counts down to the apocalypse. Steven Kleinberg's new book, Prophetic City, Houston on the Cusp of a Changing America, on Avid Reader Press, breaks that wheel. The longtime Rice University sociologist has crafted a linear narrative, a march of demographic trends that points forward rather than simply bouncing between economic poles. Houston's older Anglos, the data shows, are being succeeded by a younger, more diverse cohort with different views, values, and economic needs than their predecessors. The majority of Harris County residents under the age of 20 are Latino. Only a fifth are white. The problems and opportunities the region deals with today are a glimpse into our increasingly multiracial nation's future. Rather than being a city of oil and gas, Kleinberg argues, Houston is a city of prophecies. All too often, nonfiction books about Houston use the city simply as the incidental setting for some scintillating tale of industrial hubris, natural disaster, or NASA spectacle. Think of Brian Burroughs' The Big Rich, in which Houston is a mere playground for oil titans like Leroy Cullen and Glenn McCarthy, or the litany of Enron books that document how Ken Lay, Jeff Skilling, and Andrew Fastow made Houstonians their collective victims in a massive case of corporate fraud. Or Jim Lovell and Jeffrey Kluger's Lost Moon, the basis of the movie Apollo 13, which cast Houston as the city that astronauts call when they have a problem. In these tellings, Houston is the place where outlandish stories just happen to take place. Portrayed as having little character of its own, it's an exotic enough setting for non-Texas readers, but it might as well be San Diego or Atlanta. So it's a relief to read a book where Houston isn't just the backdrop, it's the story. Kleinberg, a native New Yorker who arrived in Houston in 1972, built this story from decades of close study of his adopted hometown. For the past 38 years, he has conducted Rice's Kinder Houston Area Survey, a telephone poll of the opinions and perspectives of hundreds of locals that was created by him and a group of graduate students. What began as a one-time effort is now a core function of Rice's Kinder Institute for Urban Research. No other American city has anything on its scale. In Prophetic City, Kleinberg combines this research with personal narrative and a concise history of Houston, making it critical reading for anyone interested in the Bayou City. The thesis, Houston's diversity, isn't new. Kleinberg repeats it every year when he releases the annual survey, but it's presented here in a richer context. The book, released just as Kleinberg turns 80, is a grand summation of his decades-long project, intertwining slices of data, interviews with prominent citizens, and prosaic vignettes that offer a vision of Houston as seen through the professor's eyes. I almost expected to read about a lunch he and I had years ago when I was a Houston Chronicle staffer at a strip mall Indian-Pakistani restaurant. A little sidebar real quick. Monkey see, monkey do, as in D-U-E, Steven Kleinberg on Houston's 80s oil boom. It was so easy to find well-paid work and high profits in those days that people used to say you could dress a gorilla in a business suit, send him downtown, and he'd become a millionaire in a week. Though a handful of books have delved into specific aspects of Houston's growth, the most recent comprehensive account was David McCone's Houston, A History, which was published in 1981, not long before the historic oil bust kneecapped the local economy. Prophetic City picks up where McComb left off, documenting Houston from its oil bust nadir to its recent peak. Kleinberg, Houston transcends the refineries and oil fields. More mundane events and locales, naturalization ceremonies, business luncheons, Chinatown strip malls are the heart of the city. As he points out often, Houston is now a city of conveners, not kingmakers. He borrowed that line from Mustafa Tamiz, a well-respected local politico and first-generation immigrant, also known as a real Houstonian, the wealthy poobah who once pulled the political and economic strings from Suite 8F at the Lamar Hotel had been replaced by a spectrum of partnerships, nonprofits, and community organizations. Plenty of Houstonians may have a chip on their shoulder about living in a place maligned by architects and urbanists as the anti-city for its endless sprawl and lack of zoning. Kleinberg reframes that narrative. Houston isn't about the place, it's about the people. Consider it appropriate that a sociologist has emerged as the city scribe. Houston's grand achievement, as Kleinberg tells it, is that we're the blue-collar city that succeeded where the Rust Belt failed. The first Houston area survey was conducted in 1982, just before the bust. It showed that 76% of respondents rated job opportunities as good or excellent. In a second survey, the following year, only 40% still felt that way. Houston seemed primed to go down the same dark road to economic perdition as other once great American cities that saw their population and economic footprint decline after the core industries peaked. And yet it was this bust, not the booms that bookended, that turned Houston into the city we recognize today. That's because Houston didn't shrink. It kept growing. This growth wasn't driven by the largely Anglo residents who made up the majority of the city's inhabitants. In fact, the Anglo population started to decline into the 90s. This growth was driven by immigrants. There are a few reasons the city drew so many new Americans. First, the federal government designated Houston a resettlement area for Southeast Asian refugees fleeing the fall of Saigon. Then came Central America's fleeing political turmoil, and then people from Cuba, Iraq, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Somalia. Many Hispanic immigrants also moved to Houston through family reunification or as undocumented laborers. Hispanic Texans from the Valley ventured north to Houston as well. Greeted by nonprofits trying to do good, business interests desperate for commerce of any kind, and landlords and realtors overloaded with inexpensive housing, all of these groups found oil-bust Houston appealing. And so did highly educated immigrants from Asia, Africa, and Latin America who came to start careers with the Texas Medical Center, NASA, and the petrochemical industries that were taking advantage of cheap crude. Without all of these newcomers, Kleinberg told me late in March, we would have had the same fate as other major American cities that are losing their status as major cities because they stopped growing. Philadelphia, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, St. Louis, Detroit. Instead, we ended up among the ranks of Los Angeles and New York and London. Throughout the book, Kleinberg himself comes off as the quintessential Houstonian, someone who arrived here from somewhere else and then made the city his own. He's friendly, always working, and persistently bullish about the city, an optimism that has remained a consistent characteristic of Houstonians in Kleinberg's surveys over the years. Don't be mistaken. He's not naive. Kleinberg doesn't gloss over the challenges that face Houston. He hammers home that, though the city is diverse, it remains economically segregated. Pollution is excessive. Flooding is a constant danger. Local government often fails to provide basic services for people who need them the most, and politicians rely on private philanthropies to help fill the gaps. At one point, former County Judge Ed Emmett tells Kleinberg the city isn't a prophetic city, but a pathetic city. Meanwhile, though the economy is diversified, the oil and gas sector still serves as the core engine for Houston's economy. The current oil bust, helped along by the coronavirus pandemic, threatens to put the city back on that apocalyptic calendar. More than anything, Houston will have to improve its education system if it wants to remain competitive in the 21st century. The priority isn't dredging the ship channel anymore, Kleinberg told me. It's investing in preschool education that will pay off 20 years into the future. Houston hasn't done that, perhaps because education has never been all that critical to Houston's economic success. Blue-collar jobs in the oil industry have long delivered a middle-class lifestyle to someone with a high school education. And when Houston firms did need someone with a geology degree, they could always hire them from Rice or import them from the University of Texas at Austin, Texas A&M University, or out of state. Because Houston has never prioritized education, our political leadership lacks the muscle memory to take substantive action. A 2013 effort to raise property taxes for Early to Rise, a universal pre-K program, was removed from the ballot due to a technicality. 2018, Mayor Sylvester Turner's plan to rescue failing schools with a public-private partnership flopped before it even started. A dysfunctional Houston Independent School District Board of Trustees is fighting a state takeover. The private sector isn't doing much better. The donor class that made its fortunes in Houston has paid it back with transformative contributions to museums and parks. Playing a role in education beyond the city's universities is a relatively new phenomenon. Kleinberg notes that local boosters during the 80s bust offered everything from free opera tickets to mortgage refinancing lessons to help the city survive, yet none of those efforts addressed the city's public school system. And despite contemporary support for charter schools, private schools, and to a certain extent, even HISD itself, the recently renamed Kinder High School for the Performing and Visual Arts is a prime example, fixing Houston's educational system will require a longer systemic investment, much larger. There's no denying that philanthropies play a critical and beneficial role in Houston. I should know, I work at one. But as Kleinberg attests, the sad fact is that most public school students have been left behind, and the University of Texas and Rice will need a lot more help if they want to compete with world-class institutions of higher education in and around San Francisco, New York, and Boston. Heck, Houston can't match San Antonio when it comes to pre-K. Kleinberg is admirably tough-minded about the city's failure to educate its children. In a city with at least 13 billionaires and private foundations with some of America's largest endowments, Houston's public schools are filled with a majority of children in poverty who will graduate without the skills needed to succeed, he writes. Those are sharp words. Frustratingly, Kleinberg tees this argument up and then never takes a full swing. The reader waits for him to name names, grab some local leaders by their figurative lapels, and demand the effort it would take to set the city's educational system on the right track, because whatever they're doing now, it isn't enough. In the end, the usually excitable Kleinberg sounds almost melancholic. The next generation of Houstonians is going to be more diverse, more tolerant, and more welcoming than any that came before, but what good is that if all but a lucky few end up poor? Houston is changing. Houston is the nation's demographic future. Kleinberg makes that much clear. Whether that future will be as prosperous as the past is a question his surveys can't answer. This is by Evan Mintz, who lives in Houston and was a 2017 Pulitzer Prize finalist for editorial writing. Next up, still in the state, this is News and Politics. It's a business by Dan Solomon and Paula Forbes. Entitled, No Store Did More. Beloved grocery chain H-E-B has been a model of emergency preparedness during the pandemic. Had plenty of practice. Back on February 2nd, the first coronavirus death outside China was reported in the Philippines. That same day, Donald Trump appeared on Sean Hannity's show on Fox News to say that the United States had pretty much shut it down coming in from China. And in San Antonio, Justin Noakes, the director of emergency preparedness for H-E-B, dusted off a pandemic response plan the supermarket chain had developed more than a decade earlier. Noakes and a handful of the company's department heads met at HEB's downtown headquarters. Sitting around a conference table, the group ran a simulation, wargaming a dire scenario, an outbreak of a deadly infectious disease in Texas. We introduced the concept of COVID-19 and what it would look like when it came to Texas, Noakes said. That gave us a moment to pause to think about how it would impact our operations and what we would do to respond. From there, teams across HEB got to work updating the pandemic plan that Noakes had developed in 2009 when the San Antonio suburb of Cibolo became the first place in Texas with confirmed cases of H1N1, commonly known as swine flu. The Emergency Management Division studied how the Chinese government had responded in the early days of the coronavirus outbreak and projected how social distancing measures such as metering customer entry and erecting plexiglass partitions might be implemented. Members of the supply chain team focused on keeping products in stock. The personnel department studied how Chinese retailers were managing a workforce that was getting sick. The product team looked to Europe for insight into changes in consumer behavior as customers began self-isolating. Within a couple of weeks of the tabletop exercise, HEB had a plan. A month later, in mid-March, as the pandemic began to surge in the United States and political leaders struggled to respond, HEB emerged as an unlikely model of foresight, planning, and competence. Executives cut store hours in order to give employees more time to stock shelves and rolled out a pay bump of $2 an hour, which gave way to permanent raises for most hourly employees in June. Purchase limits were imposed on in-demand products ranging from beef to toilet paper. The company established crowd control and social distancing procedures and tapped partners in other industries, such as restaurant suppliers and beer distributors, to haul products to its stores to avoid shortages. These steps often came days or even weeks before other large supermarket chains implemented similar measures. After Texas Monthly published a web story in March on HEB's pandemic planning, Arnold Schwarzenegger tweeted that the company's response was a masterclass in preparation and being ready to support your community. HEB's success stands in contrast to the way the Trump administration and some state governments have handled the pandemic. Americans struggled to get tests and spent much of March and April trying to parse rambling, often contradictory presidential press conferences for official updates about the disease. HEB, which employs a chief medical officer, rolled out a dedicated coronavirus hotline its workers could call for screenings and health information. Coronavirus swept through meatpacking plants across the nation, including in Texas this spring and summer. HEB, which operates its own meatpacking facilities, applied the same social distancing protocols it implemented in stores and avoided a single case for nearly 3 months, even as production ramped up to a 24/7 cycle to meet the needs of customers. An HEB spokesman acknowledged that some workers tested positive in June and July, but wouldn't give a precise number, adding that none of the infections had been linked to the plants, all of which led to questions. How had Texas's favorite grocery chain, beloved for its deep bench of house brands and commemorative Selena tote bags, emerged as an example of planning and readiness? How was a regional supermarket company better prepared for a global pandemic than its larger competitors and even the federal government? In 2017, as Hurricane Harvey ravaged the Gulf Coast, the city of Beaumont lost water pressure, leaving residents with empty taps as floodwaters rose around them. City officials called on the state to help restore service, but were told that assistance wasn't immediately coming. Officials with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, meanwhile, explained that it would take days to get past the flooding. And that's when Noakes got a call from someone working for the city. He said, "I know that I'm asking a lot, but what can HEB do to get water to the citizens of Beaumont?" Noakes recalled. Soon, images of HEB semi-trucks hauling tanks of water into storm-ravaged Beaumont went viral on social media, and HEB's disaster response became a meme among Gulf Coast residents. "I'll see your FEMA and Red Cross," one declared, "and raise you my Texas grocery store." HEB had begun developing a deeper understanding of the role it could play as an emergency responder in 2005 after Hurricane Rita struck Southeast Texas, said Noakes, who has been with the company since 1994. "We learned early on after Hurricane Rita that power is very important to keeping HEB stores running," he said. "So the company increased its fleet of mobile generators." Flooding talked the company about importance of having potable water sources, hence the water tankers. Noakes took on his current role as Director of Emergency Preparedness in 2008, watching for hurricanes, tornadoes, flooding, and other potential disasters in Texas. "When you feed half the people in Texas, it's your responsibility to be open during times of crisis," Noakes said. In 2017, following Hurricane Irma, HEB partnered with San Antonio Spurs legend Tim Duncan to deliver 400,000 pounds of food to the Virgin Islands, where the NBA star was born. Last fall, after tornadoes swept across Dallas, leaving a 15-mile trail of destruction in their wake, the company sent its mobile kitchen to the city to feed storm victims. "We are in a year-round state of preparedness for different emergencies," HEB President Craig Boyan said. "It helps that the company is an emergency preparedness department," he noted. "If you're constantly thinking about those things, you're more likely to be able to address them." "Almost everything they do is proprietary to HEB," said John Springer, the executive director of the supermarket trade publication, Winsight Grocery Business. "So when a situation like the coronavirus comes up, they're better able to use their own resources, data, and people to coordinate a response than someone who is relying on what the federal government is telling them." That internal planning has manifested itself in specific ways during the pandemic. "Manufacturing so much of what we sell has been a real source of strength as we've been able to serve our customers in ways that other competitors maybe haven't been able to," said Martin Otto, HEB's chief operating officer. "By running its own meatpacking plants, for example, the company has been able to avoid the shortages that some of the grocers have faced." Inside HEB, executives and store managers alike promote a philosophy of corporate self-reliance built around a mythology that dates back to the company's founding in Kerrville in 1905. According to Connie Barrera, who manages HEB Plus and Shirts just north of San Antonio, this corporate culture gets inculcated in employees from the moment they first put on their name tags. Some of it is storytelling and setting expectations, she said. One possibly apocryphal story that gets passed around a lot involves an unfortunate warehouse worker in San Antonio who once failed to deliver water to Randolph Air Force Base during an emergency. The president of the company personally intervened. It was made abundantly clear what the employee's responsibility was, Barrera says. To be sure, HEB has faced challenges throughout the COVID-19 crisis. Until it was stabilized in June, the online system through which customers can order grocery for curbside pickup or delivery offered a spotty experience. That same month, as Governor Greg Abbott aggressively rolled back public safety measures, HEB stopped mandating that customers wear masks, citing the difficulty in enforcing such a rule without a statewide order. When local officials in part of Texas began imposing requirements in late June, HEB stores in those locations put mask rules back in place. And the company's temporary pay hike of $2 an hour was instituted after employees circulated an online petition demanding a raise amid the dangers and privations of working long, grueling shifts during a pandemic. In early July, HEB employees were disappointed to learn that a generous temporary discount on groceries would be expiring. The next day, the company set out an electronic coupon for a free mango, a perk that some workers described as demeaning. Despite the stumbles, HEB is proud of its track record. As other meat production facilities have become COVID-19 vectors, HEB's plan has been almost completely disease-free. And unlike other large retailers, including Kroger, Target, Walmart, and Whole Foods, HEB maintains an online list of when each store last had an employee list test positive. Most crucially, its supply chain remains strong, ensuring that shelves are stocked with staples. But this story, unfortunately, isn't over yet. The pandemic has evolved from a new emergency demanding an immediate response to an evolving crisis, changing how Americans eat, work, and shop. With that comes a new challenge. How does HEB ensure that stores are open, stocked, and safe in a world where the current crisis could drag on indefinitely and another crisis could come at any time? For customers, the supermarket experience has dramatically transformed over the past several months. Early in the pandemic, admission to stores was regulated with shoppers standing in line outside 6 to 8 feet apart, waiting to be allowed in. March and April, the toilet paper aisle looked like a Soviet-era state-run food store. As the summers progressed, customers have grown used to paying more for meat. Employees at the register wear masks and stand behind a plexiglass shield. Customers are reminded to use hand sanitizer and are required to wear masks. For some shoppers, dealing with all that seemed too risky or stressful, which led to a boom in online grocery orders. Those systems, which had been in place at various supermarket chains, including HEB, got a serious workout in the early days of the pandemic. Jag Bath, HEB's chief digital officer, told Texas Monthly in April that the company was caught off guard by the shift. We're seeing increases in demand for curbside and home delivery that, quite frankly, we were not expected to see for a number of years, Bath said. Customers often experience long waits to schedule pickups and deliveries, frequent shortages on product deliveries, and only partial fulfilled orders. Might find yourself with hot dogs with no buns, for example. Even as HEB's digital and e-commerce services have improved, the next crisis is looming, threat to the supply chain. Runs on yeast, flour, and toilet paper have largely come to an end, at least for now, but circumstances could change. The public response to the information they receive, so the consumer might start feeling a little bit of anxiety, like, I need to go buy some more groceries because something's happening, says Doug Baker, Vice President of Industry Relations for the Supermarket Trade Organization Food Marketing Institute. We saw that happening all the way through this crisis, where we had unprecedented demand, then it started to abate and come down, and then the news cycle spikes demand. As the summer harvest season got underway, cases of COVID-19 began ticking up in Arizona, California, Florida, Georgia, and Texas, states that collectively produce about 85% of the nation's vegetables. Outbreaks at meat production facilities led to shutdowns, consumer panic buying, and an increase in meat prices. In early May, more than 1,000 Wendy's restaurants stopped serving hamburgers because of beef shortages. By the end of that month, U.S. pork production for 2020 was down 6% from the previous year. So far, HEB has maintained its stock of meat products, but the spread of COVID-19 or another crisis could further disrupt availability. The nightmare scenario for Texas this summer could be an uncontrolled outbreak of COVID-19 across the state as a hurricane bears down on the Gulf Coast. If a storm were to make landfall in Texas, folks on the coast might find themselves looking back with nostalgia to the days when there was just a pandemic to worry about. There would be a demand along the coastal areas for some of the same product types that would be demanded for a surge in the virus as well. That would be the most challenging scenario, said Otto, HEB's chief operating officer. In June, Justin Noakes led another tabletop exercise to game out such a scenario. This time, the team met via Zoom with dozens of participants from across the company. Noakes came away optimistic. Even in the event of a hurricane, HEB would be able to keep sought-after essentials on the shelves across Texas and also meet customer needs in areas affected by the storm, all while maintaining safety measures for employees and shoppers. In recent months, HEB has invested in more warehouse space, purchased additional trailers for hauling products, and increased capacity in its manufacturing facilities. Noakes said that many of the lessons learned from this round of COVID are now just part of running a business that has to be ready for natural disasters at any time. Hurricane, pandemic, the doors must stay open. The past few turbulent months have been more than just a logistical challenge for HEB. They have put the company's philosophy that customers should see it as more than just a grocery store to the test. When HEB rolled out its slogan, "No Store Does More," a decade ago, it may not have anticipated just how high it had set the bar. And that, my friend.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
The Humane Society of Odessa, 7012 Mockingbird Lane, is offering curbside adoptions, vaccines, warmer, and more. Shelter hours are from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Only one person is allowed in the office and kennels at this time. For applications, vaccine, or additional information, call 381-5503 or 257-4311 or email shelter@odessahumanesociety.org. To see current pets available or to private message the shelter, visit www.facebook.com/Humane Society of Odessa.
Starting Tuesday, we continue the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's summer reading series with Dave Barry's over-the-top mystery, Insane City. Seth Weinstein always knew Tina was way, way, way out of his league, which is why he's still astonished that he's on a plane heading for their wedding in Florida. But Seth has absolutely no idea what he's about to get into. A simple drink or two with the boys sparks a series of events that will pit Seth and his friends against everything and everyone imaginable. From his very powerful, very disapproving, soon-to-be father-in-law, to the federal government, to a love-struck orangutan, the outrageously funny and irreverent Insane City by Dave Barry. Starting Tuesday at noon and Wednesday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 100 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-80s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 80s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the August issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with the open road essay titled In the Belly of the Whale. A down-on-his-luck wanderer searches for answers on the lonely coastline of the Golden Triangle by John Nova Lomax. By any standard, I should have been content. I had a prestigious magazine job. I was married to the woman of my dreams. My son, John Henry, was thriving in the Army, and my daughter was doing very well in junior high. And yet, I was drowning myself in alcohol. with every light on my instrument panel flashing red, in January 2019, I quit yelling at the ocean and consented to treatment. Emerging a month later with a diagnosis of acute, long untreated PTSD, I blinked back at the wider world, fully sober for the first time in a decade. I got in my 2003 Honda Accord and went off in search of something I would find along the way. At the time, I was half-heartedly participating in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my choice of higher power teetered between St. Francis of Assisi and my own ancestors. St. Francis eventually receded into the shadows as I committed to a crude form of ancestor worship. It seemed rational, scientific. We are, to some degree, who our genes command us to be. In knowing who I came from, in coming to know the ghosts who made me, perhaps I could find new strength and wisdom. Chasing those phantoms took me as far as Mississippi and the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia. But the search bore the most bountiful harvest very close to my Houston home, in the storm-racked and lonely coastline of the Golden Triangle, framed by Beaumont, Port Arthur, and Orange. There, the seafaring people of my maternal grandmother, Charlotte Ann Susie Plummer Taylor, settled back in the late 1830s. They'd had an outsized influence on my life, both by nature and nurture. To steep myself in their lore was key to understanding both who I had been before rehab and who I would like to be after. To know this salty bunch better, I moved to the beach on Follett's Island, just west of San Luis Pass. There I lived sparsely in the Accord, sleeping in the reclined passenger seat next to a clump of salt cedars. I made that grove my own and established a routine, rising with the dawn and watching the sun ascend amber and purple from the Gulf waters. Then I'd drive a mile or two down the beach, scattering sanderlings, gulls, and oyster catchers along the way to an access point for the Blue Water Highway. I'd grab a coffee and a taco and check myself into a cubicle at Freeport's Public Library, where I'd work on magazine stories all day long. By night, I saw myself as a high-tech Karankawa tribesman. As the moon rose and bathed the gulf in glittery white light, I'd listen to the wind and waves as I conjured the ghosts of Plummer's past via genealogy apps on my iPhone. Soothed by the unending subtleties of the ocean power, it was easy to feel close to my Plummer folks. I'd long been steeped in Plummer legend, thanks to my now 94-year-old grandmother, Susie, the first daughter in four consecutive generations of ship captains. Susie would sit in her big four-poster bed in our rambling old home in Houston, dogs at her feet and a needlepoint canvas in her hands, and resurrect the salty phantoms of our heritage in her lilting, old-timey, coastal Southeast Texas accent. Her clan's lineage hung on the wall in a needlepoint sampler knitted by her maiden aunt, Julia Plummer, the longtime head librarian at Lamar University. Aunt Julia had lived some of these stories and heard others from her own Aunt Jessie, the first of the Texas Gulf Coast Plummer Lady storytellers. In the fullness of time, those picturesque tales came to resemble, in my mind, the magical realism of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, only with the Golden Triangle as our Macondo, and our Plummer family its Buendias. My family's stories had it all. Infidelity, pestilence, shipwrecks, war, incest, alcoholism, heroism, reversals of fortune, and harrowing nights of terror amid the roiling waters and howling winds of the great storm of 1900, and slightly lesser tempests. One windswept night on Follett's Island, I decided that in order to better bring these stories in my head to life, I would have to go to my ancestors' old stomping grounds on the salt-crusted rim of the Golden Triangle. I found little trace of the family's presence in either Beaumont or Port Arthur, the two cities they reluctantly settled in after the hurricanes of 1886, 1900, and 1915, finally chased them from the Gulf's very edge. My great-great-grandfather, Captain Fred Plummer's fine old home in Beaumont's South Park neighborhood was long gone. Dotted as that land is with grassy vacant lots, a boarded-up warehouse or two, and crumbling old homes, it was hard to recall the time when the neighborhood bustled with life, spilling over from the port of Beaumont, mere blocks away. Aside from 39 Plummer graves in Magnolia Cemetery, about all that tangibly remains of my family in Beaumont is a reading room in Lamar's library, named after Aunt Julia. This absence goes double for Port Arthur, and especially its city center, where the A now hangs crookedly from the lettering on the former Port Arthur News building. The paper, along with much of the rest of the economic life of the city, decamped north of State Highway 87, or to satellite towns such as Groves, Nederland, and Port Neches. Downtown was forlorn. On my first visit, trees grew out of the windows of the abandoned federal building's top floor. This was not the Port Arthur Captain Howard Plummer, my great-grandfather, had known, but it wasn't all suburban flight and urban decay. In the old part of town, a Baptist church had been repurposed as the Bhuman Buddhist Temple. Refinery giant Motiva was transforming three of the city center's grand old edifices, including that federal building, into office space. And the city's splendid Museum of the Gulf Coast, and you have the makings of a stunning turnaround. "If you can save Port Arthur, you can save the world," said my friend Kevin Russell, a Beaumont native and Austin musician, better known as Shiny Ribs. This was not long after he closed out a raucous summer 2019 homecoming show at Corville's Kitchen, near the rice fields west of Beaumont, with his lovely, seldom-played Raining in Port Arthur. I had been rattling off to him many of the town's problems, among them coastal erosion, brought on in part by global warming, and the endless parade of ever more vicious storms blowing off the Gulf. Save Port Arthur, save the world. If this was possible, I thought to myself, it was possible I could save myself. When that epiphany hit me, I was standing on the levee close enough to Port Arthur's docks to hear the hypnotic thrum of the idling engines of a tanker at anchor. This was very near the site of the Plummer family's grand triumph back in March 1910. The story of the Port Arthur Moby Dick has been told and retold many times over the past century plus, but likely never more skillfully than by Texas adventurer and writer Gayne Young. In a 2019 article for Sporting Classics magazine, Young described the ghost-gray hide, worn from age and heavily scarred from decades of fights with deep-roaming squid and battles with rival males competing for breeding rights. Young went on about how an overzealous pursuit of a school of squid had mired the whale atop a shallow sandbar in the old oil pond, a huge natural oil slick of unknown origins that once floated off Sabine Pass before it mysteriously vanished shortly after absorbing the whale. Near that muck, Captain Cod Plummer, brother of my great-great-grandfather, Fred Plummer, was at the helm of his steam tug dubbed Florida. Off in the distance, he saw a tremendous commotion, geysers of mud and water flying up from the Gulf waters. Thinking it was a ship in distress, Cott set course for the ruckus and found not a ship, but a sperm whale, 63 feet long and weighing 65 tons. Naturally, Cott had to catch it and tow it to port. But how? It turns out snaring a whale is not unlike roping a steer. After the whale snapped a series of smaller ropes, Cott tied a hawser, a giant rope used to moor tankers, around the animal's tail, just above the fins, and set the Florida on course for harbor. The whale had other plans, though. It fought back hard, and at times yanking the Florida in reverse, despite the best efforts of the steam tug's 350-horsepower engine. 5 hours later, they'd made the 8 miles to dock, and there the circus began. News of the Leviathan crackled through telegraph wires coast to coast. amazed locals jostled to be first in line to see the still barely living monster of the deep. Soon the small town was overwhelmed with visitors from nearby towns. So, for ease of access to the public, the whale